The first few days of November 1886 were a time of great changes and momentous events. Anyone reading the New York Times on November the 2nd, for example, would have seen the headline, "Liberty Torch Lighted, an illumination aided by a brilliant exhibition of fireworks that was seen by thousands on shore and on the water." This was a lighting up of the lamp held by Liberty herself, the great statue that had been brought over from Paris as a gift to the American people. Designed by Frederic Bartholdi and with an inner frame by Gustave Eiffel himself, the statue now stood sentinel over the waters of the Atlantic Ocean. The New York Times described the moment of illumination. "Suddenly, a red glow far above the flood, whitening and brightening each second, a score of points beneath quickening with splendour, broad torrents of light downward, upward and crosswise, catching every salient with quivering flame, great Liberty flashed from the solid darkness and stood in Her Majesty revealed." The paper also reported on the activity surrounding the New York City mayoral election that was being held that day. More than just reporting, it saw fit to urge its readers to vote for Mr. Roosevelt. The election would be won by the Democratic candidate Abraham Hewitt, with the Republican Theodore Roosevelt coming third after the Labour Party's Henry George. The day also saw a much less heralded event. November 2nd, 1886, "Be it known that I, Augustin Le Prince of the city, county and state of New York, have invented certain new and useful improvements. The art of producing animated pictures of natural scenery and life on glass, canvas or other prepared surfaces, of which the following is a full, clear and accurate description." Louis Le Prince, through his patent lawyers O.D. Munn and A.E. Beach of the firm Munn & Co., submitted to the Patent Office in Washington, D.C., his application for a patent for his motion picture receiver and deliverer. The diagrams included in the application show a machine with 16 lenses. The Shadow Traps, Episode 29, Be It Known. While Le Prince's facilities for his motion picture experiments in New York were relatively makeshift and his commercial prospects uncertain, he was nevertheless committing himself and his family to a future in America. In 1886, he began the process of becoming an American citizen and took out his first papers to that effect. The Prince was excited enough about motion pictures to have made a list of possible subjects for his films written out in English and sometimes in French on notepaper, and we looked at some of these in previous episodes. But a detail about it that I enjoy is that on the same pages as these lists are other more technical notes and diagrams, for example, sections of machinery sketched out as if he were working out specific problems. There are lists of things he would need, for example, a focusing cloth. That's a cloth that you see draped over the back of an old camera under which the photographer's head and shoulders disappear. Lantern rouge, a red light for the developing room. Pyrogallic acid, which is used as a photographic film developer, a square shaft, a tooth wheel, etc., etc. These few pages offer a hint of Le Prince's comprehensive grasp of his undertaking. These were not just broad conceptual notes to be handed to an engineer. These were the details that he was working out himself. He was a filmmaker and engineer, technician and artist. Also, these slight sketches and scribbled reminders to obtain equipment demonstrate, I think, a technical literacy and an element of thought and specificity of thought that suggests that Le Prince genuinely knew what he was doing. In a way, say, Wordsworth Donisthorpe's 1876 provisional patent for an obviously flawed and derivative camera did not. One sketch of Le Prince's is of a strip of images, and consistent with what people like Adolphe told us previously, the images were circular, in common with a lot of magic lantern images of the times. And these ones show four frames of a sequence of someone fencing. And along the edge of the strip of images are what seem to be diamond-shaped perforations. Now, because the sketch shows images, this is not a view of the inside of the camera. It must be the images that have been exposed and fixed and prepared to feed through a projector. So we have a confirmation here that, for projection at least, Le Prince had already envisioned the use of perforations to control the movement of frames when playing back a film. And look here, amongst what looks to be a shopping list, a tooth wheel. A tooth wheel is used to make a row of perforations, and so we see yet more evidence that Le Prince was onto the idea of using, I presume, sprockets and sprocket holes to control the movement of film, which is a really important part of making film happen. How he would eventually use perforations in his machines will become a moot point later, but we can see him exploring the idea, and not just exploring it, but putting a tooth wheel on his shopping list so that he can get one and use it. As I say, I think these notes of Le Prince's would repay further and more detailed analysis. Each little annotation and scribble might be decoded to reveal a world of information. I think they might also help to illustrate something which I think has been overlooked in the past, and that is the almost sudden complexity of Le Prince's work, and in particular, the fact that the first machine of his whose workings are actually described to us is a roughly made wood and cardboard Ferris wheel viewer, which seems to be a pretty simple adaptation of existing optical toys of the time. To go from that to that wonderful multi-lens device that we've discussed a little bit previously, with its instantaneous shutters lined up and triggered successively in sync with alternately revolving reels of film, is quite a leap. And it makes me instinctively think of Wordsworth Donisthorpe, who went from a fairly flawed and derivative provisional license in 1876 to a camera that would by 1889 or 1890 be able to actually take pictures. I would, however, compare Le Prince favourably. I think too many questions still remain as to how Donisthorpe went from one machine to the next, which we can discuss later. Whereas Le Prince seemed to have possessed the ability to move from a basic viewer to a multi-lens camera in just a couple of years. The minutiae of his notes seem to suggest that he was busy working out the details for something quite complicated. But how on earth did he manage to get there by 1886? Coming at this, as I am, from a not particularly technical background, I instinctively feel that there are two things that could have helped Le Prince get to the complexities of his 1886 camera design. And the first is simply this. Le Prince could have made a simple but game-changing conceptual leap. I say simple as if it were child's play, but what I mean is that a single eureka moment may have provided an insight that would have made everything seem suddenly achievable. What could that eureka moment be? Perhaps looking at Edward Muybridge's row of separate cameras, each one triggered separately, and thinking, what were the advantages in technology today? I could fit these cameras into a single box. Or perhaps he bought a multiplying camera, one of those cameras that took several photographs at once, so that the photographer could choose the best one. Perhaps he got one of those and took it apart and said, all I need to do is alter the triggers to the shutters so that instead of all going off at the same time, they went off in quick succession. Yes, that would work. To say, take this camera, tweak it to stagger the shutters, and voila. It's still not that simple, but you see how quickly it can be made to look very viable. The second thing is that Le Prince combined a perfectionism with a technical literacy that came at least in part from working for years with Whitley Partners. And so he would, as many others must have done, have broken down the requirements of motion pictures into its constituent parts. You would need a strip of film to take many photographs in quick succession. You would need a way to move this strip at speed intermittently past a lens, and you'd need a shutter that was synced up with the movement of the film. Having broken all this down, Le Prince could then have built up the requirements of his machine and his familiarity with the workings of engines, boilers, pistons, screws and valves, etc., etc., must have helped. For example, a handle turns a shaft, a cam on the shaft revolves, an eccentrically mounted cam revolves and pushes forward whatever is placed in front of it. Again, this is greatly, ridiculously simplified. But it is this basic grammar in mechanics that would have allowed Le Prince to painstakingly construct a working machine. Le Prince, who had worked so discreetly these past couple of years, now felt ready to apply for a patent for his designs, which would afford him some protection for his work as he went public with it. He employed the services of the firm Munn & Co. and began to describe to them his work. A description of the design he wanted to patent was later found in Le Prince's papers and included in Lizzie's unpublished, unfinished memoirs. This letter is remarkable, I think, because the description he provides Munn & Co. includes a facility, albeit described in only general terms, for incorporating sound into his films. In The Receiver, the use of a set of lenses, the shutter and system of shutters in combination with a double set of drums and pads with cam and the focusing socket, the connection with a receiving phonograph, the same works by hand, pressure or electricity. Now this provides an example of Le Prince's ambitious nature, and before we go on, I'd just like to address that quickly. Right from the first episode of this series, I've questioned the importance, and in fact the very nature of firstness. And I think that what a film actually is subjective enough to make the idea of firstness an unreliable indicator of the worth of Le Prince's achievements. His greatness lies elsewhere, I think. I'll discuss this in more detail later, but in short, his greatness lay in the depth and the ambition of his vision for film. And I think we just get the merest taste of it in the New York years. For example, Le Prince spoke to his friend Henry Wolfe about work he had done on connecting a phonograph to his machines to achieve sound with his films, and of his intention of one day having moving panoramas in colours as well. And Adolphe echoed this idea that Le Prince had envisioned from the start a form of total cinema. To Augustin Le Prince belongs a credit for the conception of, and first attempts to build in 1885, a machine which would record life and movement with allied sound, these twin phases to be subsequently reproduced at will. And Lizzie wrote that he even designed a specially constructed people's theatre for bringing out some stereotypical effects. In Le Prince's papers, his letter to Munn and Co. described a multi-lens camera with its shutters firing successively onto two rolls of alternately moving strips. This is a multi-lens camera that we've described in previous episodes, and combining it with a receiving phonograph to capture sound. So we're not just talking movies here, we're talking talkies. In the letter, the deliverer, now that's a machine that played back the images, was presented as a surprisingly different design. It involved the system of two discs revolving alternately with a revolving disc in quadrant opening. Okay, well, here's something different. Now, how should I describe what I think this is? The main idea behind the deliverer bore some similarities with a phenakistoscope, stroboscopic discs, the wheel of life and other optical devices which placed a sequence of images around the edge of a disc which was spun fast enough to bring the sequences to life. A disc with images around the edge that spun around bringing those images to life. Except that there were two discs, two alternately revolving discs. I would suggest that the idea behind two alternately revolving discs would be similar to the idea of having two alternately winding film strips in the camera. In other words, it shared the workload. A disadvantage of this would be a slight parallax, which is the flicker and jumps caused by images from slightly different positions. An advantage would be the doubled amount of images passing before the eye per second. And if we return to the idea of slightly altering the timing of mechanisms with some tweaking, it's possible that this type of viewer might have played back stereoscopic moving images if both wheels turned at the same time, offering up simultaneously two views of the same subject taken from slightly different positions. A peephole device attached to this might well allow simple stereo loops to be played back. That's exciting. But let's go back to the idea of the discs turning alternately. Attached in front of these discs is a small revolving disc in quadrant opening. Now, I believe this is describing what is also known as a rotary shutter. I've actually described how this works in the first episode because there would be, in years to come, a rotary shutter working on Le Prince's later one-lens camera. And here it is, making an early appearance in a very different device. To remind ourselves how a rotary shutter works, quadrant opening basically means that there was a quarter-sized hole, not in the centre but in one corner of the disc. As a circular shutter spins around, the hole, of course, spins around. And when the hole is over the image, the shutter is effectively open and the image can be seen. And as a disc revolves, the hole will reveal the first image on the first wheel, and then the first image on the second wheel, and then around again so that the first wheel has by this time wound on, so when the shutter opens, the viewer sees the third image in the sequence, and then the shutter reveals the fourth image which is on the second wheel, etc., etc. The notes found in Le Prince's workshop were incomplete, so this letter to Munn & Co. is missing pages. By the means described on pages 1 and 2, the prince wrote, for example, pages 1 and 2 now long since gone. Now, references to page numbers only work referring to very specific documents, because page numbers can change depending on font or handwriting size or spacing or rewrites, etc. So that references to page numbers here, as opposed to specific patent claims or specification numbers, suggests that this was a write-up of an intended patent application to give first to patent lawyers for further refinement. And indeed, whether it was the result of advice from others or not, at some point in 1885 or 1886, Le Prince reined in his ambitious plans and decided to pursue the more realistic aim of patenting a motion picture receiver-deliverer without the facility for sound. I'm sure sound would have been put back into the equation at some point, but for now, I can imagine his lawyers advising him to keep the design simple, to get the core idea of it protected before moving on. And so, on 2nd of November 1886, he submitted his work. November the 2nd, 1886. Be it known that I, Augustin Le Prince, of the City, County, and State of New York, have invented certain new and useful improvements. The art of producing animated pictures on natural scenery and life on glass, canvas, or other prepared surfaces, of which the following is a full, clear, and accurate description. In the patent application, a series of elegant drawings displayed the outlines of a mahogany box in which nestled a dense matrix of gear wheels, rods and pinions. Le Prince, the draughtsman who had catalogued in such detail everything from spanners to water heaters to weighing cranes for Whitley Partners, had now created something entirely new. A machine with which it becomes possible to record, and by means of the deliverer to reproduce afterward, the aspect of any scenery, meeting, procession, races, etc., under fair conditions of light. The camera was laid out in great detail, with 16 lenses, 2 rolls of gelatine or other substance film moving behind them, and shutters released by triggers connected to a battery and rotary switch. Although the diagram showed 16 lenses, the patent made a point of stating that different numbers of lenses could be used, 3, 4, 8, 9, 16 or more. It was, in essence, the multi-lens camera with alternating strips of film that we've looked into in previous episodes. And we'll look at all of this in more detail in the next episode, which you won't have too long to wait for this time. We have now arrived, I suppose, at the point where the camera really emerges into the light, where Le Prince begins to go public with his work, and where a momentum takes us from New York to Paris to Leeds, and then who knows where. I'll put some of the patent documents onto my Patreon page, and you might discover even more in them than I have. This episode is being recorded in March 2020, at a time in which it is easy to feel despondent. For what little good it might do, I'll be working to bring out the next episode as quickly as I can, because we still need our moments of distraction, and the world still needs its stories. Anyway, Le Prince's design was beautifully illustrated and explained in great detail, much more so than many inventions of the time in patent applications. It existed at this point as an invention on paper only. Previously, the US Patent Office had required working models to be built of the designs, but in 1876, a US committee heard the call for this requirement to be changed, because the patent office attic coffers were stuffed full of models, and there was no space to store the 20,000 or so models expected to come in that year alone. What an Aladdin's cave that must have been. A patent application was rarely straightforward, as a patent office would often ask for clarification on points or for amendments to certain specifications, citing prior art or the existence of similar or overlapping technologies. It was, by nature, a reiterative process. However, the prince would come to find that his correspondence with the examiners would become increasingly protracted. It would drag on for over a year. Something which he would come to view with a combination of frustration and increasing suspicion. Thank you for listening to this episode of The Shadow Traps. If you'd like to know more about this project or to help it in any way, please visit the Patreon page at www.patreon.com/theshadowtraps. Thank you very much for listening.